Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dusty Wismuth, and he'll be answering your most important questions on improving your casting fundamentals to catch more fish. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dusty a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dusty Wismuth about improving your casting fundamentals to catch more fish. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing, the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and an online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's W-Y-O-Trout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. That's 1-307-237-5997. Before we introduce Dusty, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And for our drawing tonight, we're giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win for tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Dusty's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate from Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And to learn more about Front Range Anglers, you can go to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. Now, to win this $20 gift certificate, which you can redeem in their store or on their online store, you must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen carefully and use your best typing skills, and the first person to answer that correctly wins that $20 gift certificate. Okay, tonight our guest is Dusty Wismuth. And Dusty grew up in Missouri, started fly fishing at the age of 8. He then began guiding and teaching fly fishing in the early 70s while working on a degree in wildlife biology at the University of Wyoming and living in Jackson, Wyoming. After graduate school, he tied commercially for high country flies and guided on the Snake Green and New Fork Rivers in Yellowstone National Park. After working as a biologist in Wyoming and East Africa, Dusty started his fly fishing school and guide service in 1995. He also served as the lead instructor at the L.L. Bean Fly Fishing School in Virginia and still teaches at the Wolf School of Fly Fishing in New York. He is a Federation of Fly Fishers certified casting instructor and is a member of the Board of Governors of the Federation of Fly Fishers Guides Association. When he's not teaching or guiding, Dusty gives casting demonstrations and workshops at sports shows from Montana to Virginia. His articles and photographs can be found in several outdoor magazines. Dusty is on the pro staff of Scott Fly Rod Company, Ross Reels, and High Drift Boats, and is a fly designer for Brookside Flies of Denver, Colorado. Well, Dusty, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thanks, Roger. It's great to be with you.
Well, great to have you. And I hear it's hot out there on the East Coast, and it's rainy and cool in Colorado. So we need a happy mix there somewhere of our weather, huh?
Yeah, I would love to be standing in some of those nice cold streams today. It was a little bit over 100 degrees here in Virginia.
When the streams are like your hot tub, it's a bit much, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I got lots to talk about tonight. Lots of great questions came in from our audience. And, folks, what we're going to try to do is break down some of the basics of casting and some of the problems that Dusty's seen over the years. And I know he believes in, you know, starting out with a good foundation means being able to do all the fancy stuff later on. So we're going to dive right in here. What we're going to start out with is we had a bunch of questions on equipment, and a lot of them are about how equipment relates to your casting situation. So the first question we had came in from Rob in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, and he asks, what brand rod reel line would you recommend in a 8-9 weight Michigan Rivers Great Lakes salmon and trout rod? And that's kind of a really broad statement, but if Dusty, you can kind of address just the factor maybe of different rod types, and does it really make a difference in your casting or learning how to cast?
Sure, Roger. In the interest of full disclosure, as you said, I am on the Scott rod and Ross reel pro staff, so I think I'd have to recommend a Scott rod and a Ross reel. in all honesty, actually, I do guide on some of the tributaries of Lake Erie in Ohio and in Pennsylvania in the fall for steelhead, and one of the things that we're looking for there is a line that really allows, or a rod, I should say, that really allows you to protect the tippet. A lot of the times we're fishing in small streams, and these steelhead are moving up into these small, many times shallow streams, and they are pretty leader shy. So you have to go down to sometimes a 5X leader, and with some of the big fish that you catch, they are easy to break off. So I like a rod, about a 9-foot rod, sometimes even a 10-foot rod, that's got a flexible tip. We're doing a lot of fishing with a small nymph and an egg pattern tandem rig with an indicator. So we're not necessarily casting a heavy fly. And many times I actually recommend a 7-weight. Now, depending upon where Rob is fishing, the types of streams he's fishing, types of flies he's using, he may be casting bigger streamers, which may warrant a heavier rod, heavier line to carry that streamer out there. But I would say, first of all, again, that what he really is going to be concerned about doing is protecting that lighter tippet that those fish are going to force him to use.
Okay, okay. Henry, I guess in Torrance, I don't know if that's his last name or where he's located, but Henry put in a lot of good questions tonight, so he's going to show up several times here with his questions. But one of his questions had to do with rods, too, and he's got rather a long paragraph here. He says, I've tried to use different lines to cast easier with a 5-weight and have had to use 6-weight. And then, on a wet, I had to use a 4-weight in the same rod. I'm thinking that the graphite handles best with dry, and the boar hand handles best with the intermediate. And he goes on and on, but he says, what does one do with so many darn variations? I would like your best line set up with which type of rod I'm running out of cash. There are just so many rods that you can buy before your garage is full. And we want to let Henry know that there is a website called TooMuchGear.com where you can get professional help having purchased too much gear and having a garage full. But all joking aside, in your casting ability, how do the different weight rods play out? I mean, you're going from a 3 to a 12 weight. Are some easier to cast? Is there a particular weight that you would give a beginner to start out with to make it easier to learn? Are some harder to cast than others?
Well, you know, the action has a lot to do with that. The simple answer is for people that are starting out in freshwater, I recommend a 5 or a 6 weight rod. It's an easy rod, easy line weight to lift off the water. And you can really let the rod do most of the work, which of course we should be doing anyway. With a 5 or 6 weight rod, you can also feel that line load the rod more easily than you could if you were starting out with, say, with a 2 or a 3 weight rod. And then if you're starting out with something much heavier, you know, a 8, 9, or 10 weight, that's just a lot of weight of line to be dealing with right off the bat. So 5 or 6 weight rod, and then as far as the action goes, I would recommend a medium-fast action. That medium-fast action tends to flex at the speed that we want it to. You know, they used to say that fly fishing was very difficult to learn, and when bamboo or even fiberglass was the material of choice in rod construction, you really had to learn to wait for that rod to load. And so the timing itself was a little bit difficult to catch on to. With a medium fast action graphite rod, it's a heck of a lot easier, and that's what I use for my students.
Okay, okay. Are there things that you need to learn about these different weight rods as you begin moving away from that 5-6? Do you treat a rod differently in the way that you cast because of its weight?
Well, just remember that the line weight is really determined by the size of the fly and how wind resistant that fly is, because that fly line is the delivery system that we're carrying that fly out to our target with. So truly the mid-range line weights are a lot easier to cast and a lot easier to develop that timing with. And you get to the point where, and I'm sure most of the fly fishers that are listening to the show have experienced, where you have a heavy fly and you can feel that fly hinge. And that really demands perfect timing to deliver a good cast. So lighter lines, lighter flies, I think, are the easiest to start out with.
Okay. Dan in Illinois asked about, is it better to start out to learn casting with a weight forward line or a tapered line or some other line?
Well, of course, all lines except the level line are tapered in some way or another. And weight forward is certainly the most common. You may see what are called bass bug tapers or trout tapers or distance tapers. And really, those are pretty much all iterations of a weight forward line. And certainly the reason that we have the tapered lines is to make that transition of the loop unrolling more efficient, because a heavy line, i.e. thick line, is unrolling thin line. So the physics of it just work better when we're casting a tapered line. So I think Dan would be well served to start with a basic weight forward line.
Okay. And we've got Spencer in Grand Junction, Colorado. Is there any disadvantages of overweighting your line, such as using a 6-weight line on a 5-weight rod?
Yeah, Spencer, I think there are. I think that the fellows that design fly rods are really, really smart guys, and they design them to cast a particular line weight. And unless you have a very good reason to do otherwise, I recommend using the line weight that the rod dictates. Now, I have run into situations where, depending upon the line, depending upon the profile of the line, once in a while you will find a rod that, say, is weighted for a 4-weight line, and it happens to cast a 5-weight better. But that doesn't seem to happen, in my experience, a whole lot. Now, some people, I know a couple of guides that guide for smallmouth back here on the Shenandoah and the Potomac River, and some of them like to overline a rod by one line weight because they feel that for some inexperienced casters, it's easier to cast the heavier fly. It loads the rod more, which is true to a certain extent, but by the same token, I think many times either underlining or overlining the rod is like driving a car in the wrong gear.
Okay. So if you're overlining a rod, a beginner might be able to feel the rod load more, and I know we're going to talk more about this, but you may not be really maybe learning what you need to learn at that point, as opposed to, you know, the regular setup where, you know, once you switch back to the matching setup, you might not be able to feel it as readily because
you've
been looking for something else and it's not there anymore.
Right. And you'll feel that rod bend a great deal, but it's going to bend too much for your casting mechanic. That's what's really going to happen. So you're not getting the true feeling of the rod.
Okay. Bob in Wisconsin asks, is there any significant loss of energy if the cast, if the loop-to-loop connections are used in the leader system, i.e. fly line to leader butt or leader to tippet? So he's asking about loop-to-loop connections in your terminal tackle there, I guess.
Yeah, you know, Bob, I really like loop-to-loop connections. I like them because they're very easy and you can change leaders very quickly. If you're switching, say, from a dry fly to a streamer and you're going to go from a long, fine leader to a shorter, heavier leader, and I think the loss of energy is negligible. Certainly you can, I always use a permanent butt section on my fly lines to attach the leader to, and I nail knot that butt section to the fly line, and of course you could use a nail knot or blood knot or double surgeons to tie the leader to the permanent butt section if you wanted a perfectly smooth connection, but I use the loop-to-loop, and it seems to work just fine.
Okay. Henry asks if you could cover knots and leader lengths for different types of lake, stream, dry, sink. And I'm not really sure what his question is after, but I guess let me change it up a bit and keep it relevant to casting. is there types of terminal tackle or configurations or knots that either are harder to cast or easier to cast or easier to lay out than others?
Well, of course, we want to go with the smoothest connections that we can, generally speaking, the most convenient, the most straightforward. And most of the commonly used knots, double surgeon's knots, and loop-to-loop connections, nail knots, blood knots, I think are going to be just fine. If he talks about leader links, then, of course, the fly line wants to unroll because it's got a great deal of mass. The leader doesn't want to unroll as easily as a fly line does, so our challenge is to get that leader to unroll efficiently as well. But if we had our druthers, we'd tie the fly directly to the fly line, but the fish aren't going to let us do that. We've got to separate that heavy colored fly line from the fly, so that's what we use a leader for. So the shortest, heaviest leader is going to be the most efficient. And I've always told my students and clients that the fish dictate how long and how heavy that leader's got to be. But we would prefer to go with the shortest, heaviest leader possible. That's going to be the easiest to cast.
So if we're streamer fishing with a short leader, you know, sinking intermediate fly line or doing some saltwater fishing with, again, short leaders generally. So those would be the easier ones to deliver. But then when you're trying to put that size 22 dry fly out there on a 12 to 15 foot leader, then that's going to be your challenge.
Exactly, because it's just a simple physics that to transfer all that energy that you're generating down that fine leader is the most difficult part of delivering the fly.
Well, maybe we can talk about that more here in a little bit.
Sure.
When we get into actual casting, because I think that is probably something that everybody would like to know more about. And we had one final question on equipment. Ava in Los Angeles wants to know if furled leaders are an aid or an hindrance to casting.
Actually, furled leaders are great. For those that aren't familiar with them, it's sort of a braided or a twined leader of many different strands of monofilament or fluorocarbon. And the great advantage of them is that they've got virtually no memory, no structural memory, and they're very limp. So they really unroll nicely. They're very smooth, and they're great. The only problem that I've found is that if you do get a wind knot in them, it's really tough to get out. But they certainly have their applications. And in delicate presentations, particularly dry fly fishing, I think they're great, and they certainly are not any hindrance to casting. They unroll beautifully.
Okay, so maybe even easier.
Right.
Okay, well, let's talk about basic mechanics. And before we do that, I'm going to take a quick break, but then we'll dive right in and try to get down to the basics here and figure out what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. So hang tight with me. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging into their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. It's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dusty Wismuth about improving your casting fundamentals to catch more fish. If you'd like to ask Dusty a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Dusty, before we jump right into those basics, tell us a little bit about your business, what's going on in your fly fishing world, and what you're up to.
Well, Roger, we're having a great year this year. You know, the last couple of years, as the economy started to take a downturn, people were sort of hesitant to commit to a new sport and buying new equipment and so forth. Our guide business was very good because people were staying a little bit closer to home, but they still wanted to go fishing, so they were fishing a lot of our more local streams. But it kind of surprised me. This spring, our school started out with a bang, and it's just kept on rolling, which is very encouraging to me. I mean, we know we all want to recreate and have fun, and it's encouraging that people are getting out into the outdoors and fly fishing. So I think we're on a good trend here, and I hope it's the same across the industry. One of the other things that I'm quite involved with in our area is the Project Healing Waters. We started it about, well, in 2005. A fellow by the name of Ed Nicholson started this organization, and the goal of it is to help injured and disabled active duty and veterans regain their coordination, regain that love for the outdoors with the challenges that they have, those who have been wounded in the war and so forth. And we started it at Walter Reed Army Hospital, and there's now over 70 different chapters throughout the U.S. and Canada through the VA and other organizations, and it's just a great, great group to be associated with, and just a wonderful project.
Do they have a website that you could...
Yeah, it's projecthealingwaters.org. Very simple. Okay. And I would encourage folks to go on there, learn a little bit more about it, and see what they can do to help out. I've never seen students, people that were so appreciative of the time spent with them in learning a new sport with the challenges that they have.
Well, that's great. You're guiding and instructing casting, right?
Right. Exactly. And if folks are interested in my operation, it's dwflyfishingschool.com. And we've got on the website some casting tips and talk about our classes and our destination trips, and we're always putting new video casting tips on it, and we're going to build that a little bit with some more aquatic entomology and just make it sort of a fun website for people to visit.
Why don't you give your website address one more time? So.
Sure, it's dwflyfishingschool.com.
And what areas do you guide in?
Well, we guide in Virginia, in Pennsylvania, in Maryland, in West Virginia. Those where we're located, all those states sort of meet, so we've got a number of different waters in those states. And then I'm also a licensed guide in Montana, and I host destination trips there every summer.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for sharing that with us, and it's nice to always hear about Project Healing Waters. It's a great, great organization to support. Okay, well, let's talk about these basic mechanics. First, we have a question from Bob in Duncan, Oklahoma, and he says, I'm a completely self-taught caster and cast fairly well, albeit somewhat unorthodox. If I want to widen my repertoire of casts, do I need to unlearn how I cast now and start from scratch, or do I simply build on what I do know and learn the correct way for future casts? And I think there's probably a lot of people, I kind of ski that way, so.
Yeah, I empathize with Bob, and you too, Roger. I learned to ski that way, and I actually learned to fly cast that way too on my own. And
yeah.
To be honest with you, I was a mess, and I'm certainly not saying that Bob is, but I'd almost have to see Bob cast, tell him what to do. But let me put it this way. If you've got good basic mechanics, then you can just build your repertoire of casts, but you've got to have good basic mechanics, or it's not going to work. You're not going to be able to advance and learn more difficult casts. I always tell my students that good casting stroke is like a good golf stroke. It's effective. The fly goes where you want to go, just like the ball goes where you want to go. It's efficient. You only use as much energy as it takes to accomplish the task, and it's repeatable. You can make that stroke over and over again. A chip is different than a drive, but if you've got a good stroke, you can modify it to fit the conditions. And it's the same with a casting stroke. So I would encourage Bob to either look at some DVDs, there's great ones out there, and look and pay attention to the basic mechanics. And if he's got a handle on that, he'll be able to progress very quickly.
And from my own experience, and we've got a kind of a question coming up about instructors and so forth, but schools. A couple of years ago, I was going down to fish for tarpon down in the Keys, and I wanted to get sharpened up with heavier equipment and so forth, and ended up hiring two different instructors here in Colorado. Both were FFF certified. The first one was pretty much worthless. He knew how to cast, he just didn't know how to teach, and I've run into that in my lifetime before where some people that are brilliant on a subject but don't know how to really explain it or show other people. And the second instructor that I had was brilliant, and he fixed a lot of things within just 1 hour of the first day, things that I'd been doing for a long time, that, you know, minor tweaks that just made all the difference in the world. And so I from personal experience, I totally believe in getting with a professional instructor and maybe get some references before you tie up with one. But, boy, there's nothing like hands-on instruction where they can see what you're doing wrong and immediately put in a correction. And so anyway, for my two cents, I really think it's worth the money. And it's amazing what an instructor can do with you in an hour or 2 hours or, you know, something like that and really fix you up. Which brings us to Kevin in New York, and he says he's new to fly fishing and he enjoys it very much but would like to get some help. but he can't afford the rates that some of the schools charge, or probably instructors. Is there a group out there that you know of that is reasonable? Is there a place where you can get instruction without paying the top prices that some of the schools or instructors charge?
Well, I'd have to say, Kevin, you're killing me.
I know that's your business, Dusty.
No, in
just
the
because
answer,
he thinks $1,000 an hour is a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
I
gosh,
mean.
I don't charge quite that much. but you know, Roger, you are right in that a little instruction goes a long way. And besides my schools, I do a lot of private lessons, one-on-one, just for the reasons that you were talking about. Somebody wants to go fish for something that they haven't done before, and they know they're going to have to learn to double haul, or they want to work on a particular technique, and private lessons are great for that. And as far as in Kevin's case, I would recommend that he goes on the Federation of Fly Fishers website, which is fedflyfishers.org, and you know, for what he'll be able to find there or the different chapters in his area. And one thing that a lot of these chapters of the FFF do is to offer free casting instruction with their meetings. And it's also just a way to meet other fly fishermen. And certainly, most fly fishermen are certainly willing to share their knowledge with people that are getting into the sport. But I would recommend that he contact the local FFF chapter or get in touch with TU, just ways to meet other fly fishers and instructors. Now, also, the American Fly Tackle Trade Association, AFTA, sponsors what they call Discover Fly Fishing. And these are free demos and free casting lessons at many of the fly fishing shows and sports shows throughout the country. So if there's going to be a fly fishing show or just outdoor show in Kevin's area, I would recommend that he check that out and see if one of the Discover Fly Fishing programs is going to be there. But there's quite a number of ways to get some free or low-priced casting instruction.
Yeah, make a good friend.
Exactly. But make sure that friend knows how to cast.
Yeah. So, hey, you know, I'd like to be your friend, but are you certified with the FFF?
And, you know, the FFF really has done their casting certification program has really generally done a great job in that, in training and certifying instructors, because certainly you can have the bad luck of hooking up with somebody that may be a great caster but not a very good instructor. And, you know, you have to have a passion for teaching to be able to pass it on.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, you might get a few references and just check.
Exactly.
We've got a couple of follow-up questions here, Dusty, about equipment. So I'm going to backtrack here a little bit. Harry in Houston asked, so Dusty talked about hinging. Can feel the fly hinge. Can he describe the term hinge or hinging?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a, and I don't want to, I'm glad Henry asked that because I don't want to confuse that with what we call hinging in the casting mechanics. When I said you could feel the fly hinge on the cast, when you make your back cast, there's that point in time where the fly line is just straight out behind you. And if you do not start your forward cast at exactly the right time, that heavy fly is going to start to drop. And when you then start to pull that line forward as you load the rod for your forward cast, you're going to feel that fly being pulled back up in line with the fly line, and that's what I call hinging. So what I was referring to is the fact that the heavier fly demands that your timing be perfect. When we've got a size 16 elk hair caddis that's straightening out on the line behind us, it kind of floats nicely, and it doesn't want to drop as much as that big number two Clouser minnow.
Yeah, big pike fly or something.
Exactly.
Like that. Okay, and another one, Paul in Duluth, Minnesota. How does the casting stroke differ when casting a sink tip line compared to a floating line?
Well, what you will find with sinking lines, any heavy fly line like that, sink tip and then into shooting heads and full sinking lines, is that the heavier that line is, for instance, with a sinking line, you're not going to be false casting. You're going to do also a roll cast pickup. That line is going to be underwater, and you can't just pull that line up through the water column with your typical lifting and loading of the rod that you would with a dry fly, just breaking the surface tension of a fly line on the water. You're going to have to roll cast, pull that line up with that roll cast through the water column up to the surface, and then go right into your back cast. So it's certainly is a little bit more difficult to learn. And once again, going back to the same thing with that heavier fly, when you've got that heavy line, whether it be a sink tip or a full sinking line or a shooting head straightening out behind you, you better have the right timing on your cast. I remember when I was learning to cast a shooting head, a fellow that taught me gave me a construction helmet when he took me out in the field. And I thought he was kidding until I piled up that first cast in the back of that helmet. I was really glad I had it.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
I think, where the term chuck and duck comes from.
Yeah. Another question from James Page and Roswell from the Internet again. Is there a practical limit to the distance you can use when you use different weight rods? For example, throwing a 100-foot fly line seems easier with my 9 weight than trying to throw over 60 feet with my 5 or 6 weight. I sometimes drop down in salt water during certain times of the year when the sea trout are small, I guess so that he can cast easier. So is there a difference in the weight of rods and the distance you can cast?
Sure. I mean, the simple answer to that is sure. You know, what can you throw further, a ping pong ball or a golf ball? You know, particularly if you've got wind to deal with, which we typically do in some form or another. So a heavier fly line has just got more mass. And so when you load that rod and store that energy in that rod and then transfer it down the fly line, it's just easier to cast for most people a heavier line up to a certain extent. Now, having said that, under ideal conditions, by that I mean no wind, you can make a 100-foot cast with a 5-weight rod. If you've watched any of the casting competitions, most of them are done with 5 weights. And, you know, you see people cranking off casts of over 100 feet. But if you're casting into the wind or even a crossing wind, that's going to be a lot more difficult to accomplish with a lighter line.
Okay, I think that catches us up on the questions off the Internet. Okay, Henry asks about grips, hand positions. Which ones are best? And I know this is something that you feel strongly about, is one of the first places you start with basics, right?
Exactly. And Henry, I would just tell you that what you need to remember is that fly fishing is a stick sport, like golf or tennis or baseball or lacrosse, and you're going to start out at the grip. And the grip that I prefer is the thumb on top grip, with the pad of your thumb flat on the cork of the rod, right up towards the end of the cork. And I like a little sort of bridge underneath that first joint of my thumb and the cork. And you're only going to hold the rod tightly enough to keep it from dropping out of your hand, because in that casting stroke, you're going to tension and untension your hand on the rod grip. And I've found that thumb-on-top grip is a strong grip, it's a powerful grip, and it's easy for people to get comfortable with. Now, having said that, if I'm fishing with my 2-weight on our native eastern brook trout streams here in the Shenandoah National Park, and a long cast is 15 feet, well, I may rotate my index finger up onto the top of the cork, and I might just almost sight down my rod for those short, very accurate casts. I'm not going to cast very far that way because I can't put as much power into the cast with my index finger on top as I can with my thumb on top. But for real short, real accurate casts, it works fine. But for the most part, I like that thumb on top grip.
Okay. He also asked about, he says he's using tennis handle wraps to give him a better grip on the rod. Do you use anything like that, or have you found anything?
Well, you know, I haven't. I wouldn't be against it. I think, you know, cork has been the material of choice for 100 years, and the reason for that is because even when it's wet or it's got fish slime on it, you can still hang on to it. And it, you know, it depresses, it deforms a little bit, so it's comfortable to hang on to all day. But I would caution Henry not to build up the grip too much, because that in some cases can lead to some tendonitis in the wrist and in elbow if the grip is too thick.
Okay. And one more question from Henry. He asks about the physical stance of your body, right-handed versus left-handed. Is there a particular, you know, stance that you should have, I guess both ergonomically and, you know, for accuracy as well?
I know there's been a fair amount of debate about this and different articles written about your stance casting, but I just approach it very simply. Once again, thinking that fly casting is kind of a stick sport, I'm a right-handed caster naturally, So I take a half step back with my right foot. That puts me in what I call a more athletic position, as if I were going to swing a baseball bat or hit a tennis racket forehand. If I make a backhand cast, in other words, with the tip of the rod over my left shoulder, then I'm going to switch my feet and have my left foot a half step back. Again, think about it as you would making a backhanded tennis shot. I find that that's most comfortable for me and most efficient, and also for my students. And I would also compare it to shooting a shotgun. If you're a right-handed shot, you usually have your left foot forward and your right foot half a step back. It's easier to swing the gun. So I feel the same way about a fly rod.
Okay, okay. What about position of the rod butt in relationship to your arm?
Well, you know, that is one of the most important things in my teaching. I feel that particularly somebody that's new to the sport, when we put a 9-foot piece of graphite in their hand with this long, heavy, colorful line, they say, you know, what the heck is this? What am I supposed to pay attention to? This line, the tip of this rod, it's way out there. But what I tell folks is, look, pay attention to what's going on at your hand. Your hand is a steering wheel. Anything that happens 90 feet off the tip of the rod or right at the tip of the rod is going to be determined by the movement at your hand. Plus, you're familiar with your hand. You've had it all your life. And so pay attention to your hand and the casting mechanics, and the rest of it's going to pretty much take care of itself. And to answer your question in a more detailed way, in my opinion, there's two positions that the butt section of the rod are going to be in relation to the bottom of your forearm. That butt section is either going to be against the bottom of your forearm or at 45 degrees to the bottom of your forearm. Opening and closing that 45-degree angle limits and defines the acceleration to a stop, the most important phase of the cast. So I really pay a lot of attention to that 45-degree angle or 0-degree angle between the butt section of the rod and the bottom of your forearm.
Where does that, I mean, I'm messing with my wrist here while you're talking, and of course the straight is pretty, I mean, I think that's the way we most often cast, right? But
sure.
When you say 45, then I'm moving my wrist left, 45, or right. Between those two, that's all you got, right?
Yeah, you know, the best way to do it is obviously a rod butt is the best thing, but if you put that rod butt in a good grip with your thumb on top, and you tip your wrist down. If you say you hold your arm out in front of you and your arm is parallel to the ground, tip your wrist down. It's going to put that rod butt against the bottom of your forearm. And that's what I call the 0 degrees. Now, if you just straighten your wrist, don't break the wrist, straighten it, that rod butt is now going to be at 45 degrees to the bottom of your forearm.
I was going the other way. I was confused.
Yeah, so think of it as just opening and closing that 45-degree angle with that rod butt against the bottom of your forearm.
Okay. Now, the significance of that.
Well, that start out with a basic cast where we've got the fly line.
Before we do that, let's take a quick break.
And okay, sure.
I won't have to interrupt you once we dive into that. So we'll be back here in just a few seconds. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing, trips, or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dusty Wismuth about improving your casting fundamentals to catch more fish. So if you'd like to ask Dusty a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. So, Dusty, you're going to talk about doing a basic cast and relationship of the wrist with that basic cast.
Sure. Well, let's say that we've got our fly line, floating line, straight out on the water, and our rod tip is right down at the water. Because what we've got to remember is that fly rod is a flexible lever, that we are lifting and propelling that flexible weight of the fly line with. So if we're going to lift something with a lever, we've got to have the tip of that lever right down where the weight is that we're going to lift. So as we pick that line up off the water, we're going to start with that rod tip right down at the water. Now, at that particular point, the butt section of the rod is going to be against the bottom of our forearm. And we're going to peel that line off the water by moving our shoulder. We're not going to move our wrist. We're not really going to move our elbow. We're going to have a bend in our elbow. We're going to start with our elbow, just our arm hanging comfortably at our side, rod tip down to the water, and peel that line off the water. What we're doing there is loading the rod, and all that means is that we are storing energy in that rod, and I call this the lift and load portion of the cast. As we break the surface tension of the fly line against the water, our rod's bending because of that resistance that the water's offering. So we're storing energy in that rod. We're moving our arm up with the butt section of the rod against the bottom of our forearm. Now, when we've peeled all the fly line off the water, and all we've got left is the leader and the fly on the water, now we're going to accelerate that rod to a stop, and we're going to be doing that by doing what I call accelerate to a clutch stop. If you've got a relaxed grip on that rod, and you lift and load that line off the water, and when you get that fly line lifted, the colored fly line lifted, if you just squeeze your hand, give it a good firm squeeze, automatically that angle is going to open to 45 degrees. And if you're casting in a vertical plane, your hand's going to end up at about ear level. There's going to be that 45-degree angle between the rod butt and the bottom of your arm. Your elbow is going to be about 45 degrees, and your upper arm is going to be about parallel with the ground. Now, that line is going to unroll in a loop off the tip of your rod. And after that line is unrolled, and here's where the timing issue comes in, we want to reverse that motion. We're going to lower and load that rod. In other words, we're going to let our elbow, we're always going to lead with our elbow, we're going to let our elbow pull our hand down. And as we pull our hand down, that fly rod is pulling the fly line. And now we're going to accelerate that rod to what I call a closed stop by closing that 45 degree angle between the rod butt and the bottom of your forearm. And you do that by pushing with your thumb and pulling with your fingers in an acceleration to a close stop. And what that does is unload the rod. In other words, it transfers that energy that we've stored as we've bent that rod, transfers that energy to the fly line, it unrolls in a loop off the tip of the rod in the direction we want our cast to go. We let that loop unroll, and then we just follow through back down to the water. So that, again, you can see now where I say that opening and closing that 45-degree angle limits and defines the acceleration to a stop, which actually is unloading the rod both behind us on the back cast and in front of us on the forward cast.
We had a couple questions about that rod loading. Keith says, what is rod loading, or what is a loaded rod? And Gene in Weatherford, Texas asks, are there some tips to help him feel the rod load? And from what you just told me, you know, you've got a loading on the, when you're picking up the line, you're loading the rod, and then when you're reversing it and accelerating forward, you're loading the rod again, correct?
Exactly. Think about it this way. Anytime we bend the rod, we're loading it. That fly rod wants to remain straight. If we deflect the rod by bending it, we're storing energy in it, but when we let go of the rod, it's going to return to its stable position, and that's called dampening, and graphite does that very efficiently. But if we've got a fly line attached to that rod, then when it dampens, when it returns to that stable position, the energy that it generates from that unloading is going to be transferred to the fly line. So simply stated, a bent rod is a loaded rod. It's a rod that has stored energy. And as far as Gene's question about some tips to help him feel the rod load, one thing that I do to give that feeling to a student is I'll stand behind that student, have them hold their rod up in the air as if they've just completed their back cast, and I'll hang on to the fly line lightly, and I'll just say, slowly let your elbow pull your hand down as if you were loading for the forward cast, and I'll just hold the line, and they'll feel that rod bend over their thumb. And I think that's a good way to start to feel that. The key is not to rush it. And another thing that you can do if you're on a flat area, a lawn or a parking lot, make your back cast and let that back cast drop on the ground behind you. And then just slowly pull that rod, pull the line with the rod. And that's something I would say to all casters is, as an instructor and a guide, I have to be very careful about the terminology I use. And I've got to be careful. If I'm guiding you, Roger, if I say, throw a cast right behind that rock, well, that's what you're going to try to do. And it's going to be a mess because, you know, you can't push a rope. What I try to reinforce is that thought of you're lifting that line and pulling it with the fly rod. You're pulling the fly line in the direction that you want it to go. And if you think about it that way, you're going to feel that rod load because you're really pulling that line with the rod instead of trying to throw the line with the rod.
Okay, good. Now, I know you use a roll cast beginning instruction. We had a question from Dave Watkins on what are the keys to a better roll cast for small streams. And he has a second part of that. But why don't you start out by telling us why you use that as a training tool and, you know, the importance about it.
You know, I think the roll cast has everything in it you need to make a good cast. And I kind of call it home plate. It's always some place to go back to when your casting stroke falls apart. The thing about the roll cast is you've got all the time in the world to make it. There's nothing that you're going to do quickly except stop that acceleration. And what I think the most common problem that people have making a roll cast is they don't let the line anchor. When you set up for a roll cast, you raise your hand up. Your hand's going to be about ear level. That the rod is going to be, rod butt's going to be 45 degrees to the bottom of your forearm, and your elbow is going to be in line with your target. And you want to then let that fly line stop floating. You want it to float and stop because that sets your anchor. Since we don't have a back cast with a roll cast, we don't have the rod loading behind us. What we've got to rely on with a roll cast is a surface tension of the water that we're working against to load the fly rod. So as we lower our elbows, we lead with our elbow towards the target and then accelerate that rod to a closed stop, that surface tension is going to load the rod. When we accelerate to a stop, we're going to unload the rod towards our target. So it's a great cast to practice because, again, you set up for that cast very slowly. And you've got time after you set up to look over your shoulder, see, and make sure that you've got that nice D-shaped loop of line hanging off the tip of the rod and anchored on the water next to you. And then you're ready to make the casting stroke. And, of course, we use a roll cast in a fishing situation. We use it, first of all, after we've shaken a bunch of fly line outside the tip of the rod. We make a roll cast first in order to straighten that line out, get the slack out of it. But we also use it on our little streams around here. I might fish all day just roll casting because we've got so much brush behind us that we can't make an efficient back cast. So we'll roll cast. And, of course, when you think about a spay cast, what's a spay cast? But a type of a roll cast where you are setting an anchor on the water that you use to load your rod.
And in fact, just a little advertisement, our next show on the 21st is going to be with Simon Gosworth on single-handed spay casting. So we'll get into great detail for the folks on doing those kind of casts.
Well, you can't do any better than Simon Gosworth. He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's the man for the
yes,
spay.
Yes, he is.
Okay, we got a couple questions on this roll cast. Barry in Minnesota wants to know, when doing a proper roll cast, does the line unroll along the water surface or in the air above?
Well, you know, Barry, I would prefer typically to have my fly line unroll above the water because particularly if I'm fishing on a quiet pool or a slow-moving current, the less disturbance I make on the surface, the better. And so I can make that roll cast so that the fly line unrolls above the water and then drops down gently. The time when you would have the line unrolling along the surface is if you're roll casting into a wind. Because again, we've already said the roll cast is not as strong a cast as the two-part cast with a back cast because you don't have that back cast to really load the rod. So if we're trying to roll cast into the wind and we do it the typical way, that wind's going to blow our cast back to us. However, if you accelerate to a stop and stop the rod tip a little bit further down, you can unroll that line along the surface of the water. And as you know, because of the coefficient of friction of the air against the surface of the water, there's kind of that, what we call the wind shadow, that turbulence right near the surface of the water. So the wind might be blowing 12 knots 3 feet up in the air, but it might be blowing 8 knots right along the surface. So you can get a little bit of an advantage and unroll that roll cast a little bit more efficiently into the wind if you unrolled along the surface. And of course, if it's windy, there's already going to be a little bit of chop, so that extra disturbance won't make a difference.
And let's see, Brant wants to know how he can get more distance in his roll cast.
Practice, practice, practice. You know, I would, again, go back to the fundamentals. I tell people to make sure on a roll cast, particularly if you're going for distance, I like to raise my hand higher because you get more leverage. Make sure that you set that anchor. Don't rush the roll cast. Also, to drop back a little bit to line design, remember you got to have thick line inside the tip of the rod to unroll that cast, particularly a roll cast, efficiently. If you have got the back end of the taper outside the tip of the rod, then you're asking thin line to unroll thick line, and it's not going to happen. So make sure that you've got the back taper inside the tip of your rod so you've got thick line continually unrolling thin line.
Okay, good tip, good tip. All right, let's talk about, you had already talked about the basic backward and forward cast. And I know in your upcoming book, which you didn't mention at our break, but you want to tell people about the book you're working on?
Sure. A dear friend of mine and fellow casting instructor, Robert DeAngelis, and I have started working on a book. Robert and I have taught together for years. We taught at the L.L. Bean School together. We also teach at Joan Wolfe School together, and Robert teaches with me at my school. And we've always tried to simplify things. We feel that that's the best way to put across the information, and we've kind of come up with this idea of casting zones, which we're certainly not trying to reinvent the wheel by any means, but we're trying to put, as Robert terms it, another layer of understanding on the cast, and I think that's a good way to put it. These zones are basically an idea that you have certain areas, certain times of the cast, when you can do certain things and when you must do certain things. It's simply stated, that's it. We use colors. We've got a blue zone, a green zone, a red zone, and a yellow zone. And you can think of it this way. The blue zone, the green zone, and the red zone are in front of the caster, and the yellow zone is behind him. To relate it to the mechanics, the blue zone is what we're doing on the back cast as we are preparing to accelerate. In other words, lifting that line off the water, loading the rod. As we lift and load that rod, that's all in the blue zone. The green zone is the acceleration. The red zone is the stop, and that's all there is to it. In that green zone to red zone, you have to be accelerating that rod towards its target, whether that target be on the back cast or the forward cast. The yellow zone is after you've completed the stop on the back cast. The drift occurs within the yellow zone. You can start to change direction during that drift, during the yellow zone. For instance, if you're hauling, you're giving line back on your haul in that yellow zone. Also, now as we start the forward cast, that's in the yellow zone as well. The lower and load is in that yellow zone. And again, you can be redirecting the direction that the loop is going to unroll. But once you get to the green zone, then to the red zone, the acceleration to the stop, and the red zone is the stop, through that green to red zone, you have to be accelerating that rod in the direction that you want the line to go to its target. The blue zone, on the forward portion of the cast, do all sorts of things. You can mend. You can do an aerial mend. You can do a reach cast. There are a number of different things that you're doing. Once you complete that forward cast, that red zone stop, you shoot line. You're letting the line go, and the line is unrolling in that blue zone. So it gives us another tool to analyze a person's cast and for that person to analyze their own cast. If you do something at the wrong time, if you do the wrong motion in the wrong zone, it's not going to work. So it's just another layer of understanding.
Okay. Need to take a quick break again, and then we'll be right back, and we'll try to solve some of our guests' problems here because we've got a lot of questions about specific things. Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop and guide service located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan. Pere Marquette River Lodge provides year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit them at pmlodge.com. That's pmlodge.com. Or call them at 231-745-3972. 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dusty Wismuth about improving your casting fundamentals. So if you'd like to ask Dusty a question, please go to our homepage and send us your question. Fill out that text box, and we'll try to get your question answered on the show tonight. Okay. Now, we've got some specific requests here, so let's kind of work through some of these. David Shull in Dallas, Georgia says, what would be preventing me from getting a nice flat loop on my cast? I pretty much stick to the 10-2 positions with quick wrist snaps and quick stops at the end of my back and forward cast. Is the 10-2 position a absolute guide in casting?
No, I don't think it is. In fact, as Lefty Cray says, hands of the clock are to tell time with, and that's about it. I think one of the things that can cause a problem using the 10-2 is that sort of indicates a person is casting in a very vertical plane. And, of course, the casting plane is determined by the line that runs from the tip of your fly rod to the point of your elbow, and that's the plane that your rod moves through, both on the back cast and the forward cast. And actually, your casting plane is determined by what's comfortable for you. I tend to cast with my arm, probably at about 50 degrees to the ground instead of 90 degrees to the ground. If you're trying to sneak a cast under an overhanging limb, you might cast parallel, you know, to the surface of the water. So that 10-2 thing is a little bit difficult to apply to those different casting planes. I think David's problem may be not necessarily the plane that he's casting through, but his timing. Because if he's casting larger loops instead of what he terms as a nice flat loop, it's probably because he may not be waiting long enough, or he says that he's making quick wrist snaps and quick stops. Well, a quick stop is very important. But that wrist movement is an acceleration. It sounds funny, but it's an accelerating acceleration to that quick stop. Hit the gas and hit the brake. You don't start that either opening on the back cast or closing on the forward cast of that 45-degree angle real quickly. So I would encourage David to look at his timing of his acceleration to either that clutch or closed stop as opposed to the plane that he's casting in. I would encourage him to find a comfortable casting plane and go with that.
Well, could it be when he's talking about snapping the wrist, and I think if I'm reading you properly, when you are moving between those two positions, it's a smooth acceleration rather
exactly.
than like a fly swatter. If you were taking a fly swatter and snapping your wrist to get the fly, that's not what you want to be doing.
Exactly, Roger. It's that smooth acceleration to a quick stop. And I also might say, again, if on his back cast, if that angle between the butt section of the rod and the bottom of the forearm goes past 45 degrees, then he's going to have trouble. Because remember, the direction that the tip of the rod is traveling, when it stops its acceleration, is the direction the tip of the line is going to unroll. That's the direction that you're telling the line to unroll. And so if you open that angle that we've been talking about, the 45 degrees, and you look at your wrist is actually straight. There's that 45-degree angle between the butt section of the rod and the bottom of your forearm, but if you look at the top of your forearm, your hand is straight in line with your wrist. And that's where it should end, on your back cast. On the forward cast, when you close that 45, your wrist is actually going to be tipped down in relation to the top of your forearm. But if he's breaking his wrist, if he's going back to 90 degrees, then he's going to be really opening up his loop behind him, and it's going to be very difficult to then form a good tight loop on his forward cast.
Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas asks, can you talk about changing the shape of your loop from tight to loose for different fishing situations and fly weights?
Sure. The reason that we would want to change the shape of our loop is determined many times by what we're casting. If we're casting a single fly, a small little trout fly, then we can cast those real efficient tight loops. That fly is not going to want to drop, and the limbs of the loop are going to easily unroll parallel to each other, the upper and lower limb of that loop, and we can cast those arrowhead-shaped loops that are real pretty. Now, if we're casting a tandem rig or a big streamer or a couple of stonefly nymphs with a couple of pieces of shot on them, we can't cast that real tight loop because we've got too much weight. We're going to have to open that loop up a little bit, and that's really determined by your timing. If you slow down your acceleration a little bit, that and smooth it out even a little bit more, and you're going to move the tip of your rod a little bit further in the stroke, that, remember, as we said, the tip of the rod, direction it's traveling when you stop acceleration, is the direction the loop's going to unroll. So if you move that tip of the rod a little bit further down as you stop that acceleration, it will open the loop at the end. And so your rig, your terminal tackle, the weight, your indicator, those two big stonefly nymphs are not going to tend to want to get tangled up with the lower limb of the loop. Another good way to do that, casting heavier flies, casting tandem rigs, is actually to change your casting plane from back cast to forward cast. You might call it a Belgian cast if you're familiar with that, where on your back cast, your fly rod, your arm, your casting plane is parallel to the water. And you actually make a curving acceleration to that clutch stop. So as you make that acceleration to a stop, it's a curving acceleration to a stop, and your fly actually goes out away from you. It makes, and it keeps that loop open during the acceleration. And then in the yellow zone, you're actually going to change your casting plane to vertical. And as you enter the green to red zone on the acceleration to a stop on the forward portion of the cast, you're doing it in the vertical plane. And what that does is keep that fly under tension all the time. There's never that point in the cast where that fly line just straightens out behind you and is virtually weightless for an instant. In that curving acceleration to a clutch stop, in that green to red zone on the back cast, that fly is always under tension. And in the yellow zone, as you're loading for the forward cast, it's still under tension. And it's a great way to cast heavier rigs.
Great, great. Sally in Manitou Springs, Colorado, asks, how do you make your line just float down ever so gently on the water so it doesn't make anything, so that the fish don't notice? So what's the trick to getting that leader straightened out and just dropping nicely?
Well, you know, there really isn't a trick to it, and I'll say it again, practice, practice, practice. It's just a function of learning to work with the fly rod. And I think we can all remember, if you're an experienced fly fisherman, one of the toughest things to learn to do is let that rod do the work and not overpower it, particularly on the forward cast. I mean, we all have a tendency, if we've come from conventional tackle or even as a kid throwing a baseball, you know, you tend to overpower the forward stroke. And I would recommend that Sally just work on the amount of energy. You know, fly fishing and fly casting is not a function of going and finding a bigger hammer. It's a function of application of the least amount of energy that you can use to make the cast work. And women actually are typically quite a bit better at that than men are. My wife is a beautiful caster because she applies the energy at the right time. If she has trouble with a cast, she doesn't go look for a bigger hammer like I do. She takes a step back and says, well, now, you know, what am I doing or not doing that's not allowing that cast to work? She figures it out and does it. So I think Sally's problem is one of probably overpowering their forward cast.
Now, when you overpower, does that create the pile?
It certainly can, because you get those sine waves. If you really hit that forward cast, you get those sine waves moving down the fly line, and it will pile up. In fact, it will bounce back on you. Certainly, if your cast piles up in the forward cast, it might be caused by other things, not waiting for the line to unroll behind you, or not accelerating to a quick enough stop on the forward cast. But from what Sally is saying, it sounds like she might just be overpowering it and having that cast bounce back a little bit.
Okay. And it looks like Bill from Nazareth, Pennsylvania, had a similar problem. And So I think we've and he mentioned, you know, trying to get that extended leader out there without a pileup cast, and he says without snapping the fly off during your cast. I'm sure we've all experienced that at one time, and when you do that, that whip effect, is that the timing issue? What are we
looking at? Absolutely. Absolutely. I tell people, if it sounds like Indiana Jones is standing behind you when you come forward for that on that forward stroke, all it means is you're rushing your forward cast. And again, that's probably the most common problem that beginning casters make, and not always beginning casters. You know, people get in a hurry to get that line moving forward again. And what ends up happening is you've got two loops moving in opposite directions behind you because you haven't allowed your loop to unroll completely. And the best way to correct that is to drop your casting plane off vertical so that you can look over your shoulder and watch that loop unroll behind you. Ideally, your fly line is going to be unrolled completely off the tip of your rod, and your leader and fly is going to be in a little candy cane shape so that when you start to pull that line forward, as you're pulling that line forward, as you're lowering and loading the rod on that forward stroke, that leader straightens out. If you do it too quickly, if you don't let that line straighten, it's just going to pop. Another great way to practice is to cast in a horizontal plane. Get that rod out in front of you on the sidewalk or parking lot or lawn. Turn your palm up. Grip the rod as you typically would, but turn your palm up and cast the rod, you know, parallel to the ground. Let each cast drop, and then you can pull that line along the ground, accelerate to a close stop, pull that line along the ground, accelerate to a clutch stop on the back cast, and it's all out in front of you. You can really see what's happening.
That was a technique my instructor used with me, and we had a rope with us, you know, to and we
rope,
just got out perpendicular
caps
to the rope, and then tried to get it so that you could practice moving that tip so that your line goes up and down the rope so that you're level.
Exactly. Another thing you can do is take out about 25, 30 feet of fly line, lay the rod tip on the ground, stretch that fly line out perpendicular, put a ball cap right where you've got a piece of yarn on the end of your leader, do it on the other end, put a ball cap down there, and then stand where you had the butt of the rod. And if your yarn lands close to that ball cap, that means you're doing it correctly on both in the back cast and forward cast.
Right.
It's a great way to practice shooting line and hauling as well.
Yeah, because you can see what's going on, which
exactly.
is a big problem. A couple of questions, one from Teresa Adams in Bakersfield, California, and also one from Dick Northbrook online. They want to know about these accelerator fly casting trainers. Dick mentions the Echo Micro practice rods, Royal Wolf version. And they want to know if those are effective, if they do help you or don't.
You know what? I think anything that's going to help you is great. You know, I think I've often thought, if you ever watch the Golf Channel, you know, how many advertisements do you see for all these things that are going to help you with your golf stroke? And I think we in the fly fishing industry are a little bit behind the eight ball here. I'm familiar with that accelerator casting trainer, and I think it's great because it's just a tool that allows you, it gives you a cue as to, auditory cue as far as your back cast and forward cast on the timing of it. The Royal Wolf Flyo that Joan and Lee Wolf designed and the Echo yarn rod, I mean, they're both short yarn rods where instead of a fly line, you've got heavy craft yarn. And casting 1 foot of that craft yarn is equal to about 5 feet of fly line. So it's a great thing to practice with inside. And I think all of those tools are fantastic because we don't always have the ability to go outside and cast.
Okay, we've got some questions. Josh Wainwright and Kevin John, Maryland, asks, please give us some insight into the problem of lining fish when they are in a position where there is no choice. Do you recommend a longer tippet? I'm going to tie that with the next one, which is Jim Edwards in Edwins, Washington. He says, do you have any casting tips for throwing a curve cast? I think those probably go together.
Yeah, sure.
How do you get to that fish that you can't reach directly?
Well, you know, this is one of the things that Robert and I are talking about in our book. One of the things that I think, again, we may not do as much as we should as fly fishermen is our preparation. And lining up a cast is kind of like lining up a golf shot, I think, where you see where you want that cast to go. That's your target. I define the target is where your fly is when the fly line straightens out. It's not always on the water. It's very seldom the fish. It might be above the water, a few feet above the water, and then that fly drifts down. It may be on the surface. But in any case, lying in the fish to define that is when we are, say, directly in line with that fish, down current from it, and we have to cast our fly so that fish has a chance to see it. And that's another thing. Our target, I feel, has to fit three criteria. You have to land your fly where the fish can see it, obviously. The fish has got to have time to assess it and decide what to do. And you can't ask that fish to move too far. A fish isn't going to swim 40 feet to get a trico. So once you've chosen your target, you may be in a situation where you can't help but cast your fly line over the fish, which obviously is not a good thing because it casts a shadow. It may splash. We certainly prefer to just our fly and a little bit of leader over it. And you would accomplish that by, if you can, moving off to the side and out of direct line with the current of the fish so that you can angle your cast and just some leader and fly line will float over. You might be able to accomplish it with the curve cast that Jim refers to. Josh might go ahead and use a longer tippet, but again, depending upon the size fly that he's casting, that might be tougher to straighten out. As far as Jim's tips for making a curve cast, there are several different ways to make a curve cast. You can overpower the rod, which will make the line snap back, and sometimes you can do it into a curve by overpowering it and dropping the tip. You can underpower the acceleration on the forward cast and then trace the curve that you want with the tip of your rod. Or the most efficient and probably the most difficult to learn is in that green to red zone when you're accelerating the rod to a stop on the forward portion of your cast is to actually roll your wrist. You roll your wrist either in or out depending upon the direction that you want the curve to work. And it takes some practice. It is not an easy cast to make. Probably the easiest curve cast to make is the underpowered curve cast where as you progress from the acceleration to a closed stop in that green zone to the red zone, you underpower it, and then in the blue zone, as you're bringing the rod tip down to the water, you're actually reaching out. It's almost like an aerial mend in describing a curve with the tip of your rod. It's not going to work for a long cast, but for short curve cast, you can certainly do that.
Okay, great, great. Well, that's unfortunately out of time already. This thing went really fast, for me anyway, and I know we still had questions to answer, but we did our best job that we could here, and appreciate it. But before everyone goes, stick with us here. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and that $20 gift certificate. So stay tuned for the next few minutes, and we'll finish up. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat. The Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it, involves this mining situation. Critical commercial, sport, subsistence, fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine, and if you'd like to help out with that, for more information, you can go to www.inletkeeper.org, that's I-N-L-E-T, keeper.org, or www.trustees.org, trustees.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can do that on our homepage in the section under tonight's show. It says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments, and we'd sure appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. If you entered our drawings, you'll be randomly selected from our registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's a little too late, but make sure you do it for our next show because you never know. You may win one of our prizes. So the first thing that we're going to draw for is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is we've talked about a couple times tonight, a great organization to support. If you want to know more about the Fed Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So our first winner is Terrence McManus in Michigan. Terrence McManus in Michigan. So Terrence, there's your one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you do have a membership already, then we'll get that extended for you. So enjoy and congratulations. Our second drawing is for a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And if you want to learn more about Fly Fusion Magazine, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com, out of Calgary, Canada, a great resource to learn about fly fishing. And our winner there is Craig Masumiya, and I may have destroyed your name there, but in Colorado. So, Craig, congratulations on winning that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion. I know you'll enjoy it. Everybody does. And now, Dusty, we have to give away our $20 gift certificate. And this is a little, I don't know. You've got a 50-50 chance on this question. So somebody will get it. And let's see here. I'm going to ask, when we were talking about doing a roll cast, you said to be effective, the thick part of the line had to be someplace on the rod. Was it inside the tip or outside the tip? Did I phrase that okay, Dusty?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to make sure I get, sometimes I ask a question and I get an answer that I didn't expect. So. Okay, our first answer is outside. Is that correct?
Yeah, but it's not correct.
Not correct. Okay, so we go to the next one here. Okay, let's see. Like I said, a 50-50 chance. So we got Silas Gray in Joplin, Missouri says inside. Sounds like he's got it, huh?
Silas is correct because, remember, we want that thick line, unrolling thin line, and if we've got all the thick line outside the tip of the rod, then all we're going to have left is that thin running line that goes back to our backing, and that thin line is not going to unroll thick line.
Very good. Very good. Okay, so Silas, congratulations. And Silas, send me your contact information, name, address, phone number, email address, and you can put it right back into that box where you just answered the question at, or send it to me at info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and then we'll get you what you need to know to get your $20 gift certificate. So congratulations. Well, Dusty, I really appreciate you being on the show tonight. Boy, it went way too fast tonight, and some of the shows are like that, but covered a lot of ground, and I think you gave out some great tips, and enjoyed talking with you.
Well, I enjoyed it very much, Roger. It was a lot of fun, and I look forward to doing it again.
Great, great. One thing I don't think you mentioned, you got any ETA on your book? And what's the title yet?
We're shooting for next spring or summer.
Okay.
And the working title is Using Casting Zones to Catch More Fish, but that's kind of up to our editor.
Okay, okay. Well, we'll be looking for that, and be sure to let us know when you get published on that.
We certainly will.
Okay. Our next broadcast will be on July 21st at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we'll interview Simon Gosworth, and our topic of the show will be single-handed spay casting. So we'll get a little extension on our casting shows here this month. Simon is going to share his techniques on using casts adapted from two-handed spay casting to one-handed casts that enable you to fish the most challenging spots that most anglers just pass by. So join us for that show. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We would like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Platte River Fly Shop, Housatonic River Outfitters, and the Bear Marquette River Lodge for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.